Today, making the news. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 22nd of September 2018. Our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The 60 Minutes segment, which aired last Sunday, put the cat among the pigeons. I made a significant contribution to the programme, both in helping to shape the story and through my interview. You can watch the segments on YouTube and also see the additional Extra Minutes segment, which was a longer form selection from my comments. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. Of course, the property spruikers accuse the program of misrepresentation, and some other contributors complained after it aired. But as I discussed in my live stream event last Tuesday, where, by the way, we had more than 400 participating live, which is a record, they have represented my views accurately. But I noted that we are talking about a worst case scenario of home prices falling 40 to 45% over 3 years, and that the headline in the introduction that it would be within 12 months did not come from me. In fact, speaking to the editor, it appears that this was from The Liquidator, which was also featured in the segment. And as a result, we suspect the ABC's Media Watch may be looking at the segment. So, to be clear, there is a 20% chance, on my estimation, that due to a disruption in the international capital markets, the property edifice here could collapse as a result of less liquidity, inflated prices, and dodgy lending practices, as highlighted by the Royal Commission, and strained household budgets, thanks to flat incomes and rising costs. But, and this is important, there is still time for policymakers and regulators to wake up and take steps to alleviate the risks. But time is getting short, in my view. Oh, and you can also read about the wager I refuse to accept from the Cook, and the article I wrote for 60 Minutes, The Debt Bomb, Which No One Wants to Talk About, which outlines my perspectives. Overall, I believe that this was an important event in raising public understanding of the issues we face, and I reject the charge that I was scaremongering, because if you've been following my channel, you will have heard it all before. Perhaps it will help some households from making poor decisions. And remember, my analysis is data-driven, and the signs are still showing further falls. For example, CoreLogic says a total of 1,983 homes were taken to auction across the combined capital cities last week. That's a slight increase on the week before. But the weighted average clearance rate dropped to 51.8%, which was not only lower week on week from 55.3%, but the lowest since December 2012. The two largest auction markets of Sydney and Melbourne both recorded lower clearance rates week on week. Melbourne returned a final clearance rate of 54.1%, down from 60% over the previous week, while over half of the Sydney homes taken to auction last week failed to sell, returning a final clearance rate of 48.6%, decreasing from the 50.6% over the week prior. Both markets did see a slightly higher volume of auctions over the week, with volumes across Melbourne up by 10.9%, while Sydney saw a 2% rise in volumes. And as usual, the performance across the smaller auction markets was mixed, with Canberra recording a stronger final clearance rate of 65.2%, while only 33.3% of Tasmanian homes sold. However, Brisbane and Perth were the only auction markets to see a week-on-week improvement in clearance rates. Across the regional auction markets, Geelong returned the strongest clearance rate of 60.6%, and in terms of volumes, the Gold Coast saw the highest number of auctions at 58. However, only 31.9% sold. CoreLogic says a higher number of auctions are scheduled this week, with a total of 2,277 homes scheduled for auction, which is up 15% on last week's final figures, although lower than 1 year ago when 2,782 capital city homes went to auction. So it looks like a weak spring sales season so far. And Domain also released research showing the strong correlation between auction clearance rates and dwelling prices, and confirming the buyer's market at the moment. They showed that the rolling annual clearance rate Australia-wide, alongside the annual growth in the Domain median dwelling price, and observed that annual movements in the two indices are highly aligned over the past 20 years. Steady demand in the property market is generally regarded as a clearance between 60 and 70%. Any lower than 60%, they said, and it is thought that the market is slowing down and prices are going down in a buyer's market. Indeed, in the week ended the 20th of September 2018, the CoreLogic 5-City Daily Dwelling Price Index, which covers the five major capital cities, declined another 0.17%, with Melbourne falling by 0.28% and Sydney by 0.14%, again showing that Melbourne is seeing the strongest declines after a later run-up. The ABS Home Price Series data came out on Tuesday, just in time for our live event. The total value of residential dwellings in Australia was $6.7 trillion at the end of the June quarter 2018, falling by $13.2 billion over the quarter, a first for years, and hardly reported. But this is significant. We need to get used to more falls ahead. Of course, it varies by location and property types, and the mean price of residential dwellings also fell, down $4,100 to $686,200. Despite the number of residential dwellings rising by 40,800 to over 10 million in the June quarter. The price index for residential properties for the eight capital cities fell 0.7% in the June quarter, and the index fell 0.6% through the year to the June quarter 2018, so the falls are accelerating, and the more recent CoreLogic series shows further falls ahead. The capital city residential price indices fell in Sydney down 1.2%, Melbourne 0.8%, Perth down 0.1%, and Darwin down 0.9%, and rose in Brisbane at 0.7%, Hobart at 3%, Adelaide at 0.3%, and Canberra at 0.6%. Annually, residential property prices fell in Darwin down 6.1%, Sydney down 3.9%, and Perth down 0.9%, and rose in Hobart up 15.5%, Canberra up 3%, Melbourne up 2.3%, Adelaide up 2.1%, and Brisbane up 1.7%. Finally, the total number of property transfers were also significantly down. Also this week, the latest migration figures from the ABS showed that a 9% fall since visa changes made in April 2017 has hit. And no surprise then that the HIA bemoaned the fall, pointing to slowing demand for new property. In fact, Australia's annualised population growth rate slowed for the fourth consecutive quarter. And over the year to March 2018, Victoria saw the strongest population growth, up 2.2%, followed by the ACT, up 2.1%, and Queensland, up 1.7%. New South Wales was fourth fastest at 1.6%, with Tasmania fifth at 1%, Western Australia sixth at 0.8%, and South Australia at 0.7%. The population of the Northern Territory has actually declined over the past two quarters, and the annual growth has slowed to 0.1%. This week we saw more tweaks in mortgage rates as the recent hikes to existing loans start hitting households. ING says that it's increasing its variable rates for investor mortgage customers by 15 basis points. The changes come into effect from Tuesday, the 25th of September, and is for both new and existing investor-owned customers. The banks have blamed the higher funding costs, and actually the BBSW has come back somewhat but remains elevated. The point is, as the majors fund some of their book from short-term sources, the funding gap is real and sustained. That said, Westpac made some aggressive moves by discounting mortgage rates for selected new customers, essentially funding the attempt to grow share from the higher returns from existing borrowers. The bottom line is that it's a merry dance of cross-subsidisation in play, as existing borrowers are forced to pay more, the back book, while certain classes of refinancing and first-time buyers are being enticed. However, bearing in mind that home prices are likely to fall further, buyers should beware. Always read the small print. We also wonder how sustainable these discounts are given current margin pressures. But I guess volume and margin can be traded off, at least in the short term. UBS has once again highlighted the issues relating to interest-only loans. According to UBS's Australian Banking Sector Update on the 19th of September, which involved an anonymous survey of 1,008 consumers who took out a mortgage in the last 12 months, 18% stated that they didn't know when their interest-only loan expires, while 8% believe that their interest-only loan term is 15 years, which doesn't exist in the Australian market. The research found that less than half of respondents, or 48%, believe that their interest-only term expires within 5 years. So UBS said, "We believe the Royal Commission creates an inflection point and credit conditions are tightening materially. Whether Australia can orchestrate an orderly housing slowdown remains to be seen, and we think the risks of a credit crunch are rising given the significant leverage in the Australian household sector." And the Royal Commission concluded its hearings relating to the insurance sector in Australia. More damning evidence highlighting poor behaviour in terms of mis-selling insurance products, charging premiums to dead people, failing to handle claims fairly, illegal behaviour, and further failures of the regulators to fulfil their role. The law is also missing in action in a number of critical areas, including claims processing. Indeed, the small fines imposed on these large and profitable businesses were just seen as a small cost of doing business. More to come when the interim report is due at the end of the month, but the behaviour of corporate Australia is once again in the dock, and it's shameful. Citi made the point that the Royal Commission exposes systemic overlending, saying that, in our view, the most material conclusion of the Commission is likely to be that the lending processes presently aren't sufficiently responsible. Responses to this issue are likely to involve increased due diligence, which will impact the growth and availability of credit further to existing measures. Bank systems have allowed them to lend too much. This is visible across the system, with issues in mortgage broking all the way through to expense verification, leading to adverse customer outcomes, as evidenced by more leverage and higher loan balances for broker loans. This will lead to a spate of legal consequences and ongoing litigation. An HEM could be banned because it led to adverse customer outcomes, as evidenced by more leverage and higher loans for broker loans. We agree, our data is pointing the same way. This is why the current credit tightening is not temporary, but marks a shift back simply to more normal, sensible practices. The debt bomb, though, is baked in. That said, S&P, based on the expectation that the general government fiscal position will return to surplus by the early 2020s, as the government's focus on fiscal prudence turns higher revenue collection into better budget performance. They view the government as having significant revenue flexibility to achieve this based on its track record of raising general government revenue faster than the growth of nominal GDP. So they revised their outlook on Australia to stable from negative. and they affirmed the AAA long-term and A1 plus short-term ratings. They said that the stable outlook reflects our expectations that the general government fiscal balance will return to surplus by the early 2020s. We expect steady government revenue growth supported by strong labour markets and relatively robust commodity prices, and accompanied by expenditure restraint. We also expect property prices to continue their orderly unwind, and that this slowdown won't weigh heavily on consumer spending and the financial system's asset quality. So that's all right then. And this despite further delinquency rises in their SPIN monthly report for July. Although Australian prime income home loan arrears rose year on year in July, they remained unchanged month on month at 1.3% since May, but up from 1.17% a year earlier. This despite arrears normally falling at this time of year. They say that high household indebtedness and low wage growth have increased borrowers' sensitivity to interest rate rises. Some borrowers, including those with higher loan-to-value ratios, are more exposed to rising interest rates, particularly at a time when lending standards are tightening and refinancing opportunities are diminished. However, Australian RMBS portfolio exposure to such borrowers is not significant. Exposure to loans with an LTV ratio in excess of 80% is just 13%. In other words, the RMBS portfolio is not necessarily representative of the wider market. Arrears movements were mixed nationwide, with New South Wales reporting a month-on-month increase in mortgage arrears in both percentage and dollar terms, while in Victoria there was a decline in loans more than 30 days in arrears. Arrears remained at a record high in Western Australia, but the Northern Territory took the nation's top spot again in July, with arrears of 2.67%. Australian RMBS portfolio exposure to the Northern Territory is minimal, however, at just around 1%. But the trend in New South Wales are concerning and mirror the growth in mortgage stress that we are seeing. Turning briefly to the local markets, the banks were mixed, with NAB down 0.32% on Friday to 27.66 and the ANZ higher up 0.14% to 28.46. The ASX 200 Financials Index moved a little higher, up 0.14% on Friday to 6,159, but remains below the peak last November before the Royal Commission kicked off. Frankly, we think the financial sector is in for a rough patch as the output from the inquiry hits and more class actions, like the one announced by Maurice Blackburn lawyers, who are preparing court proceedings against the major banks and brokers in regards to alleged breaches of the NCCP. Turning to the Aussie, the main bear trend is getting tested as the Aussie-US is nearing a 50-day simple moving average and the multi-month bear trend from late June 2018. It ended on Friday at 72.91, a couple of percentage higher, and it could break above the 72.94 to 73.07 zone, which was the August 13 high, to target 73.83, the August 21 high, and 74.85, the July 10 high. This is in reaction to a weaker US dollar, as we will see shortly. And so to the US, where the Dow soared to record heights for a second straight day on Friday as defensive stocks turned to offense on falling US Treasury yields. Trade-sensitive stocks such as Boeing and Caterpillar pushed the Dow into record territory this week, as both post strong weekly gains. The VIX Fear Index was lower, down again 1.02% to 1168, signaling relatively steady sailing in the near term. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 0.32% to 26,743. On the other hand, the S&P 500 fell 0.04% to 2,929, while the tech-heavy Nasdaq composite fell 0.51% to 7,987. But beware, trading was volatile today due to quadruple witching. where stock options, stock index options, stock index futures, and single stock futures all expire. I'll be very surprised if the Fed doesn't raise rates at the upcoming meeting, but it's also the end of the quarter, and they want to keep the markets at record highs so they can print up pretty charts and graphs to show you how you need to put your money into the markets. The 10-year Treasury yield slipped on Friday following strong early week gains as the benchmark Treasury breached the key psychological 3% level earlier this week ahead of a widely expected US interest rate hike next week. The gap to the short term, here the LIBOR rate, is still compressed, warning of potential stress ahead. The Fed will make a policy adjustment on Wednesday at 2 p.m. and also will extend their economic projections out to 2021 for the first time, so it will be interesting. Ray Dalio, who founded Bridgewater Associates, the world's biggest hedge fund, this month predicted that the U.S. economy is about 2 years from a downturn, and former Fed chairman Ben Bernanke shared that view of a possible decline in 2020, when fiscal stimulus wanes, like Willie E. Coyote is going off the cliff. China and the United States earlier this week imposed less harsh than expected tariffs on each other, helping lift sentiment on trade. In sharp contrast, US-Canada talks were set to end the week with little sign of progress, as a key White House official suggested that the United States could move ahead with a revamp of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the NAFTA agreement, without Canada, ahead of a US-imposed deadline of 1 October. We're still talking to Canada, and we're getting very, very close to the deadline where we're going to have to move ahead with Mexico all by themselves, the White House official said. Pollsters are saying that there is a 75% likelihood that Democrats will take the House. That will cripple any chance of further US tax cuts, but more importantly, it will curb Trump's ambitions on trade and leave the US deadlocked once again. Energy, meanwhile, also racked up gains supported by the broader markets as oil prices rebounded from lows, which followed a report suggesting major oil producers were set to discuss plans to boost output. On the New York Mercantile Exchange, crude futures for October delivery rose 40 cents to settle at $70.72 a barrel. And at the moment, the cryptocurrency prices are near their lows, but unleashed by Trump's trade war, sanctions, tightening of the monetary policy create a favorable environment for the long-term cryptocurrency's growth, especially in the emerging economies. Bitcoin rose 3.96% to $6,782, and Bitcoin got support on approaching the bottom at around $6,000. However, in the nearest future, the benchmark cryptocurrency will have to face the test of the important resistance level. An important resistance level descended into the region of $7,000. In case of taking it, the cautious bulls should also await the confirmation with crossing the previous peak of $7,500. Without taking these levels, it will be difficult to talk about a change in the trend. The US dollar rose against its rivals on Friday as investors reined in appetite for emerging market currencies, while the pound racked up losses as the UK and EU reached an impasse on a post-Brexit deal. The US dollar index, which measures the greenback against a trade-weighted basket of six major currencies, rose 0.4% to 93.84. UK Prime Minister Theresa May criticised the EU for rejecting her post-Brexit plans, citing it unacceptable, particularly as the bloc failed to put forward any alternative proposals. May further claimed that the UK and EU were at an impasse, denting optimism for a post-Brexit deal agreement following recent reports that the EU was set to adopt a warmer approach to Brexit talks. The pound US dollar fell eroding most of the week's gains as the pair looks set to end the week roughly flat. The dollar was also supported by profit-taking on emerging market currencies like the South African rand and the Turkish lira, both of which have enjoyed sharp gains on the back of improving sentiment in developing economies. Turkey unveiled a new economic program earlier this week to reduce its current account deficits, while the South African Central Bank left interest rates flat on Thursday. Elsewhere, the euro-US dollar fell 0.29%. The single currency was set, however, to post a second straight weekly gain ahead of an important week as the Italian government is slated to release its budget on Thursday. And so in the short term, the financial markets look confident, though below the surface there are shadows lurking as higher Fed rates put more pressure on corporate bonds. Locally, though, the next 3 months will be testing, given the outfall from the Royal Commission, tighter credit and falling home prices. And to reinforce that, the RBA has confirmed what we all knew, namely that banks do and can create money. Deposits follow. See our post, How Banks Create Money. This underscores the need to actively manage credit, rather than arguing, as many do, that because for every credit there's a debit and for every asset a liability, credit growth is unimportant. Yes, many still do hold this view, when in fact it is availability of credit which drives home prices. And because credit is now getting much tighter, the downward forces mean home prices are set to continue to fall. And just as in a rising market, high prices begets more loans, so less lending can only drive prices one way. Yes, we are indeed for a fall. The question is how far and how fast. Time, of course, will tell. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've heard here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.